If I told you that a promotion at work, and maybe just a bit of extra cash in your bank account was the primary driver of global carbon emissions, you would probably think I was skipping a few steps.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it sounds like quite the leap when you put it like that.
Right. It really does. But the fastest way to trace the health of our planet isn't actually looking at smokestacks. It's looking at what you put in your grocery cart.
Exactly. It really all comes down to the individual grocery budget.
Yeah. And today, our mission on this deep dive is to explore exactly how rising incomes in developing coastal countries like fundamentally alter human diets, and how that simple everyday shift creates this massive, almost invisible ripple effect across our oceans and our climate.
It is such a fascinating chain reaction, really. We are looking at how individual choices at the market intersect directly with planetary health.
Yeah, every choice sends a signal.
Right. It sends a powerful, quantifiable signal to the ecosystem, dictating what lives, what dies, and frankly, what gets pumped right into the atmosphere.
To really see this in action, we're unpacking a 2023 study from the journal Environmental and Resource Economics.
That's a great paper.
It really is. It's titled Fish Protein Transition in a Coastal Developing Country, and it focuses specifically on Ghana. And honestly, this isn't just some dry economic paper.
No, not at all.
It reads much more like a detective story about human behavior, deeply ingrained cultural habits, and some seriously difficult environmental trade-offs. So welcome to this deep dive. Let's get right into the baseline here.
Sounds good. Let's do it.
So we are looking at a part of the world where fish is not just, a menu option. It is the absolute bedrock of survival.
Oh, completely. The scale of dependency is just staggering. Globally, the fishing sector employs roughly 42 million people.
Wow, 42 million.
Yeah, and the overwhelming majority of those livelihoods are concentrated in coastal developing nations. I mean, in low-income food deficit countries, nearly 20% of the average per capita animal protein intake comes directly from fish.
20%. That is a massive chunk of their diet.
It really is. We are talking about the primary source of food security for about 1.5 billion people globally.
But the problem is, I read recently that something like 60% of global fish stocks are fully exploited right now.
Unbelievably, yes.
And another 33% are just outright overfished, which, if I'm doing the math right, leaves almost nothing in the healthy column.
Right. You're spot on. The study refers to this as a severe crisis of biological overfishing.
Biological overfishing. Okay. Oh. What exactly is driving that?
Well, the pressure comes from a combination of things. You have inadequate management and then these perverse incentives like governments subsidizing the cost of fuel or boats.
Oh, so they're basically paying people to fish more than they should.
Exactly. It artificially encourages way more fishing than the ocean can physically handle. And on top of that, populations are simply growing faster than the biological resource can replenish itself.
Wow. Okay. So the researchers zoom in on Ghana's artisanal marine fisheries to make this tangible. And when they say artisanal, we aren't talking about massive industrial trawlers, right?
No, no. We're talking about local fishermen using planked canoes, often just with outboard motors.
Just simple canoes.
Yeah. Yet that localized, small-scale sector contributes about 70% of Ghana's total marine catch.
70%. That is incredible. Just from small boats.
It is. They are out there catching small pelagic species. So things like sardines, anchovies, mackerel.
Right.
And these fish are so vital for affordability and basic nutrition that they have actually earned the nickname, the people's fish.
The people's fish. I love that. But I'm guessing the metrics behind the people's fish are painting a pretty grim picture right now.
Very grim. The ocean simply cannot keep up with the canoes anymore.
Yeah. The numbers in the study prove that point aggressively. I was looking at this in 1992. The average catch per canoe in Ghana was about 35.4 metric tons.
Which is a solid yield.
Right. Yeah. But by 2016, that average catch had plummeted to just 15.52 metric tons.
Less than half. And if you break that down to the catch per individual fisherman, it fell from 3.2 metric tons to just 1.7 metric tons in that exact same time frame.
Oh, man. So they are doing the same amount of work for half the reward.
Actually, the physical effort remains incredibly high, maybe even higher. They are going further out to sea. They are spending way more money on fuel for those outboard motors, spending more hours on the water, but the yield is just fundamentally broken.
So imagine doing the exact same job, using the same tools, putting in the same intense physical labor, but your paycheck is slashed in half over two decades.
That's a perfect way to put it.
That's exactly what these artisanal fishers are experiencing. And the downstream effect on the general population has to be immediate, right?
Oh, absolutely. Because of this declining domestic production, fish consumption per person in Ghana dropped from 32.5 kilograms in 1999 down to just 21 kilograms in 2016.
21 kilograms. And what is the recommended national requirement?
It's 40 kilograms.
Wow. So they are barely hitting half of the recommended intake.
Barely half. And this creates a massive void. I mean, you have a rapidly growing population. The local traditional protein source is disappearing, but simultaneously, the country's economy is developing.
Right. So people are, on average, slowly making a bit more money.
Exactly. And that intersection, less fish available, but more money in pockets, it forces a dietary shift.
Okay, so I'm somewhat familiar with the concept of the nutrition transition, like in places like post-war Europe or, you know, modernizing parts of Asia, where urbanization usually means people drop local grains and wild game for processed wheat and industrial meat.
Right, the classic transition.
Yeah. Is Ghana following that exact same blueprint, or does the coastal geography change the rules for them?
The blueprint is remarkably similar, honestly, though the local flavor definitely changes. Historically, a traditional diet in these coastal communities relies heavily on locally produced wild-caught foods.
Like the coarse grains and starchy roots.
Exactly. Coarse grains, starchy roots, and of course the people's fish. But as urbanization takes hold and markets integrate, diets shift. People move away from those traditional staples.
And what are they moving toward?
They transition toward diets rich in saturated fats, refined carbohydrates like imported rice, and crucially, domestic livestock. So we're talking beef, goat, and poultry.
So the economic driver behind this is what researchers call positive income elasticities.
Right? Yes, exactly.
Which means, quite simply, that these new diets, the processed foods, and the domestic meats are usually more expensive than locally produced staples. So wealthier people are much more likely to adopt them because they finally have the capital to afford them.
You nailed it. The moment household budgets expand, you don't just see them buying a larger volume of food. You see an immediate pivot to more expensive, calorie-dense foods.
Right. They upgrade their plate.
Exactly. But, you know, assumptions are dangerous in economics. To prove this wasn't just a localized trend in, like, a single wealthy neighborhood, the researchers needed to look at the entire country.
And they did. They pulled a massive data set from the Ghana Living Standards Survey, specifically the sixth round, known as GLSS6.
That's right. It covered over 16,000 households nationwide.
16,000. And this isn't just like some quick online poll?
No, not at all. Researchers physically visit these households multiple times. They are meticulously tracking food consumption and expenditures, making sure they capture the actual realities of the daily budget.
So what is the current average Ghanaian protein budget actually look like?
It's really fascinating to look at. Fish is still utterly dominant.
Really? Even with the transition?
Oh, yeah. On average, a massive 75.1% of a household's animal protein budget goes to fish.
75%. That is huge.
It is. The rest is split into much smaller slices. So chicken sits at 11.7%, beef at 10.3%, and goat meat at a really modest 2.9%.
So fish is still the undisputed king of the plate.
Absolutely. But the study uncovered a critical nuance using something called the Suits Index.
Okay, the Suits Index. Break that down for us.
Sure. So the Suits Index is this brilliant mathematical tool originally developed to measure whether a tax system is progressive or regressive.
Oh, okay. Like how a progressive tax takes a larger percentage of income from high-income groups.
Exactly. And a regressive tax takes a larger percentage from low-income groups. So the researchers applied this exact same logic to household protein budgets. They plotted the cumulative percentage of total protein expenditure against the cumulative proportion of expenditure on fish.
Okay. And what did they find?
They found a negative index, specifically negative 0.421.
Okay, so it's hard to visualize negative indexing in a budget, but it's basically like upgrading your house as you get wealthier, right? Like, you still have a kitchen, and it might even be a bigger kitchen than your old one, but it takes up a much smaller percentage of the total square footage of your new house because you've added, like, a dining room, a home theater, and a gym.
Oh, that is a fantastic analogy, yes.
So you're still spending money on the kitchen, but your priorities for the extra space have shifted entirely.
The data maps perfectly to that analogy. Wealthier households spend more money on protein overall, but a significantly smaller proportion of that money goes to fish.
I see.
Yeah, their absolute spending on fish doesn't disappear. But as their overall animal protein budget expands, they fill that new space with meat, beef, goat, and chicken.
That makes total sense. And even within the fish category itself, there's some really interesting cultural and logistical quirks, right?
Definitely.
Like when looking at the fish budget, Ghanaians heavily favor smoked fish, which takes up over 41% of the fish budget. Dried fish is next at 19%. And fresh fish is only 14.9%.
Yeah, and what's driving that preference isn't just taste. I mean, it's a structural reality of the developing world.
Right, because of the refrigeration issues.
Exactly. In tropical climates, cold chain infrastructure, meaning reliable refrigeration from the boat all the way to the consumer's kitchen, is incredibly expensive and often totally inconsistent.
So they have to smoke it.
Right. Smoking and drying preserve the fish. It extends its shelf life drastically without needing a fridge. And over generations, that necessity locks in a specific flavor profile.
Oh, wow. So the preservation method actually shapes the culinary culture.
Completely. That smoky umami flavor becomes the foundational taste of traditional West African soups and stews.
That is so cool. Now, the demographic variables in the study were what genuinely surprised me.
Yeah, they were pretty counterintuitive.
Right. Because you might assume more education correlates with higher wealth and therefore a faster shift toward industrial meat.
That would be the standard assumption, yeah.
But the data showed that larger households, older heads of household, and more highly educated people actually spend a higher proportion of their protein budget on fish.
Yeah, the education correlation tells us that diet isn't solely dictated by raw income. Educated populations often possess a greater awareness of the nutritional benefits of fish.
Like the omega-3 fatty acids.
Exactly. They know it's healthier than the saturated fats found in beef or goat. And the older generations, meanwhile, they are resisting the nutrition transition out of deeply embedded generational habits.
They like what they grew up eating.
Exactly. But the most surprising twist is geography.
Oh, right. Urban households spend a lower proportion of their protein budget on fish compared to rural households. Which is crazy because many of these major urban centers in Ghana, like Accra, are located right on the coast.
Right on the water.
Yeah. You would think proximity to the ocean equals more fish on the plate.
You would think so, but geography is fighting against infrastructure here. Urban areas are the epicenters of the nutrition transition.
Because they have the stores.
Exactly. They have the modern supermarkets, the imported goods, the fast food chains, and the cold chain logistics to actually support massive domestic meat sales. The commercial environment dictates the diet just as much, if not more, than the physical proximity to the sea.
Wow. Okay. So we know wealthier people and urban populations are shifting the percentages of their budgets toward meat.
Yes.
But what happens to the average person when the price of that disappearing overfished people's fish inevitably goes up?
Well, that's where the researchers use something called the AIDS model to test elasticity.
Right. And the elasticity is essentially just economists testing how far they can stretch a consumer's wallet before it snaps.
Right? So that's a really great way to frame it. Elasticity measures sensitivity to price changes. So if a price goes up and people immediately abandon the product, the demand is highly elastic.
Right.
But if the price goes up and people just absorb the cost and keep buying it, the demand is inelastic.
Yeah.
And the AIDS model, which stands for Almost Ideal Demand System, by the way, revealed that fish in Ghana is extremely inelastic. A 1% increase in the price of fish only drops demand by 0.96%.
Wow. So people just eat the cost.
Literally and figuratively, yes.
They rely on it so heavily that they will stretch their budget to the breaking point before giving it up. Chicken, on the other hand, was shown to be highly elastic, right?
Very much so. If the price of chicken goes up, demand drops sharply.
But eventually, I imagine even inelastic demand hits a wall.
It does. If fish prices rise so high due to biological overfishing that a household is finally forced to make a change, the math shows they pivot directly to beef and goat meat.
Okay, so they are direct substitutes.
Exactly. If fish gets too expensive, the demand for beef and goat rises to meet the baseline protein requirement.
But here is where we hit that amazing cultural quirk that defies standard economic substitution. The data showed that if the price of chicken goes up, the demand for fish actually decreases.
Yeah, it's a fascinating anomaly.
But if they are substitutes, shouldn't they buy more fish when chicken gets expensive?
Well, in a standard Western economic model, yes. But in this specific context, chicken and fish are not substitutes at all. They are what economists call complements.
Complements, meaning they go together.
Exactly. And the reason they go together is purely culinary. In Ghanaian culture, chicken and fish are very often combined in the exact same soup pot for traditional dishes, like light soup or palm nut soup.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Yeah. The smoked fish provides the flavor base, and the chicken provides the bulk protein.
I love that detail. I mean, you can build all the complex economic models you want, but sometimes the hard data just comes down to what tastes good together in a soup pot.
It really perfectly illustrates why local context is essential in data analysis. I mean, if you can't afford the chicken for the soup, you just don't bother buying the fish to flavor it.
Right.
But crucially, neither fish nor chicken is ever culturally mixed with beef or goat meat in those traditional dishes.
Ah, okay.
So beef and goat remain true economic substitutes for fish.
Let's follow the thread of those substitutes.
Yeah.
Because this brings us to the ultimate catch-22 of our entire deep dive today.
The big dilemma.
Yeah. We know the coastal oceans are being chronically overfished. And we know rising wealth and rising fish prices are pushing populations to substitute their protein with beef, goat, and chicken.
Right.
So if people transition away from capturing wild fish, it could theoretically reduce the biological pressure on those dying coastal marine stocks.
Mm-hmm. In a localized vacuum, yes. That substitution is a massive relief for the marine ecosystem. But the study brings in some heavy-hitting environmental data regarding the carbon footprint of these different proteins.
And that's where the localized relief becomes a global nightmare.
Exactly.
Let's break down those carbon numbers because they are pretty shocking. An artisanal fisherman in Ghana, using an outboard motor on a planked canoe, produces less than 0.5 kilograms of CO2 equivalent for every kilogram of fish caught.
The efficiency of wild-caught fish is just incredible because the input is virtually zero.
Right. Nature did all the work.
Exactly. You aren't clearing land, you aren't growing feed, and you aren't irrigating pastures. You are just burning a small amount of fuel to harvest a naturally occurring resource.
Okay, now compare that to the meat substitutes that wealthier households are transitioning toward. To produce a single kilogram of chicken, it generates 6 kilograms of CO2 equivalent.
Which is a massive jump.
Yeah, that is already 12 times the carbon footprint of the fish.
And it scales up aggressively from there. A kilogram of goat produces 20 kilograms of CO2 equivalent.
Wow.
And beef. A single kilogram of beef produces a massive 35 kilograms of CO2 equivalent.
35?
Yeah. The gap between 0.5 and 35 is driven by the sheer biology of cattle.
Right.
I mean, they require massive amounts of land and water. The logistical chain to grow and transport their feed is immense, and they naturally produce methane.
Which is a brutally potent greenhouse gas.
Exactly.
It is just a terrifying paradox. If developing nations successfully reduce pressure on the marine ecosystem by having populations substitute local fish with domestic meat, we're essentially trading a localized marine biodiversity crisis for a massive global spike in atmospheric carbon emissions.
It's tragic.
Yeah. Solving one problem inadvertently pours gasoline on another.
It really highlights the danger of operating in silos. You know, you can't just draft a fisheries policy to save the oceans without understanding that it immediately impacts your agricultural policy and your climate policy.
Well, everything is connected.
If developing coastal nations follow the exact same meat-heavy nutrition transition that Western nations did throughout the 20th century, the global carbon math simply doesn't work out.
The atmosphere just cannot absorb it.
No, it can't.
So let's do a quick recap of the journey we just took. We started in the local canoes, looking at a resource, the people's fish, where catches are shrinking drastically, despite the physical effort remaining exactly the same.
Right.
We saw how as communities urbanize, you know, gain access to supermarkets and get a little wealthier, the fundamental shape of their grocery budget changes.
The suits index in action.
Exactly. Thanks to the suits index, we know they spend a smaller proportion of their expanding wealth on fish, shifting those funds toward industrial meat. And finally, we saw the climate paradox that results from trading a hyper-efficient, low-carbon fish for a high-carbon cow.
That's a great summary. And I think the most vital thing to pull from this research is that this isn't just a Ghana story. Ghana serves as a perfectly documented case study, but this is really a blueprint of how economic growth impacts the environment worldwide. The mechanics of the nutrition transition happen everywhere.
Yeah, every single time you choose a protein at the grocery store, you are participating in this exact same economic and environmental matrix. You are balancing your personal household budget against the Earth's finite resources.
The researchers actually leave us with a rather profound takeaway in their conclusion regarding that.
Oh, what do they say?
They note that once populations transition to a meat-heavy modern diet, they become incredibly reluctant to ever go back.
I can see that.
Yeah, even in highly developed wealthy nations where consumers are perfectly aware of the environmental costs of industrial meat, achieving large-scale dietary change is just incredibly difficult.
Because the habit sets in.
Exactly. Once the palate adapts to the calorie density of meat and the wallet can support it, the habit sets like concrete.
So the real question is, are we biologically hardwired to eat our way through the planet the moment we can afford to?
It is a sobering thought.
It's a terrifying question, honestly. But one we desperately need to answer before the people's fish disappear for good. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.